This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi, I'm Cassie Huff with you for The Country Hour today. Coming up, the World Agricultural Supply and Demand estimates suggest it could be reason for optimism that grain and oilseed prices could be on the rise. And yesterday I mentioned that 300,000 snapper fingerlings are going to be released into the Spencer Gulf. But will they survive?
Monitoring is the key to this. Just releasing fingerlings and forgetting about them and crossing your fingers is not the way to go.
I'll have more on what's going to be needed to ensure their survival later in the program. But while I'm talking fish, there's been a lot of turmoil in South Australia's fishing industry in recent years. A lot of fishermen have been asking themselves whether or not they would have retired following the state government's fishing reforms, which included buying back some fishing licences. Lucas Forbes spoke to some fishers about how they feel about finally docking for good.
Mason, shut up.
Retired Port Pirie fisher Michael Slattery now has more time to spend with his dogs since he took part in the state government's fish licence buyback scheme. Mr Slattery says after a life on the water, he felt like it was time to do something else.
Well, I took the opportunity of taking the buyback, yeah.
And what's been your experience in that, your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it had to happen. There's too many fishers. It's not, the industry's not really viable. There's a few making good money and probably the bulk making a living, that's all, yeah.
And so you would have put yourself in that second category?
In the second category, yeah.
So with the licence buyback, how much was your licence worth in the end?
Well, I took $180,000 I got for the licence, yeah.
And how does that compare to the value?
Well, it was probably double what you could have got, prior to the buyout. If I had to try and sell it, yeah, it'd be at least double.
Streaky Bay Mayor and former fisher Travis Barber isn't retired from working, but said he felt the quota system proposed at the time was unsustainable for his business.
Ultimately, I took the buyback because the quota system that was being mooted to come in. And once I received my possible indicative quota, I just couldn't see it financially viable for me to keep fishing, as I would have had to purchase or lease extra quota, which would have in the end made it just not affordable for me to do that.
So what was it that made it unaffordable? You touched on it there, you'd had to lease more licences, but what were the factors there that made it really, that in your mind made it unaffordable?
Well, for me to make a living out of whiting fishing, you need to catch sort of around 5 tonne of King George whiting. For me, the indicative quota I received was 87 kilo. So obviously I would have had to purchase 5 tonne of whiting quota, and the figures that were being bandied around just didn't make it viable for me to buy that much quota. With what was happening with licence fees, obviously with a quota system, obviously there's more fisheries and there's more paperwork that's involved, which means your fees go up, and the indicative fees that were you received to where they were headed, I just couldn't see myself staying in it any longer.
Streaky Bay Mayor and former fisher Travis Barber only found out after he handed in his licence that he would not have to be subject to a quota system. Despite that, he's confident he made the right decision to get out. However, here's how he responded when asked how it feels to no longer be able to call himself a professional fisher.
Hard. Every day, especially days like today when it's nice. I drive past and see all my old mates out there pulling the crab pots and heading off whiting fishing. It's hard. It's in the blood. And I miss it. I miss it very much. But look, that's what happened. The fishery needed a reform. It needed a change. The people that chose to stay in have made that commitment, and I wish them all the best, and I just chose to go a different path. So totally understand why the government did it. It had to be done. There were too many fishermen. But yeah, as we all know now, that after I handed my licence in, the rules got changed up on the Eyre Peninsula, near the western end of Eyre Peninsula. They've actually gone to Olympic quota, so they don't have a quota system now. So it actually went the opposite way to what we thought. But I think that was also a good decision by the minister in the long run as well.
Do you think if you had known that at the time, you would have handed your license in?
I wouldn't have taken the buyback if I knew it wasn't going to quota up on the upper west coast. No, I wouldn't have. But I'm comfortable with my decision. We've invested money that I got from the buyback into another business, and that's the way it is.
Streaky Bay Mayor and former fisher Travis Barber ending that story from Lucas Forbes, that look back at some of the people who did decide to dock and hand in their licences and I guess how they're feeling about it now. Moving away from the sea to land-based industries, the international demand for grain and oil seeds is expected to rise, according to the latest World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates. The first report for 2021 shows high demand for wheat, canola, soybeans and corn across the world. Chicago-based analyst and vice president of the Prices Future Group, Jack Scoville, says that should mean better or at least stable prices for Australian producers as well.
Well, trends actually turned up on the daily charts here in wheat, in all three classes of wheat, the hard red winter, the soft red winter, and the hard red spring, all had trends turned up. Part of that came off of the rallies in corn and soybeans, but there had to be something else going on to send all three classes higher. And that was the increased demand for U.S. wheat. So I think we'll see somewhat higher prices here in the United States. World prices will probably be sideways to higher.
What are some of the real standouts elements of this report in your eyes?
Well, I think one is the corn production estimate came in sharply below trade expectations. In fact, well below the lowest trade guess for both yield and for overall production. That was a huge surprise, and that sent corn futures limit up over the course of the day. Our demand picture remained less because of the less production, but the offsets in the demand were not nearly enough to offset the loss in production. For soybeans, The demand side was the main feature of interest there. USDA did cut the ending stocks estimates to 140 million bushels, which is extremely tight, and implies that they're not seeing any demand rationing right now. And they also increased export demand by 20 million bushels and domestic crush demand by 5 million bushels. So even with the rather stable production estimate over there and supply estimate over there, our demand side is taking more and more of the soybeans and leaving us with less and less.
So internationally, what effect does high demand for corn and soybeans have on the rest of the world?
Well, it's going to raise prices for corn, for soybeans, and for wheat, for that matter. The world needs the grain and needs the oil seeds, especially the Chinese, and that's the main message of the report here today. They're going to take corn from the U.S. They're going to take beans from the U.S. They're going to take wheat from the U.S. Hopefully Australia, but if Australia doesn't get wheat, doesn't sell wheat to the Chinese, they can sell it to everybody else because everybody else will be selling to the Chinese. So there is a lot of bullish feelings left over by the report here today, and I think that it means that internationally and here at home we're going to see higher prices.
And higher prices for just those three commodities, or for other commodities as well?
Well, other commodities as well. Canola is making new highs every day, for one, on the oilseed side, and then the grain side, rice, another futures market that we trade here, had a preliminary breakout to the upside, and that was based on really large domestic demand that completely caught the market by surprise. So I think that there's reason for optimism, and even oats turned up here in Chicago. So there's reason for optimism for higher prices along a whole wide range of grains and oil seeds here.
Chicago-based analyst Jack Scoville speaking with Lucas Forbes. Now, while I'm talking about crops, You might have heard of this before, watering stress. So perhaps taking water away from a crop in the middle of the growing period can actually sometimes lead to higher crop yields. This has been around for a while, but there's some new research showing that it could work in loosened seed as well. The results of a Loosen Australia trial at Keith is showing that an average of 26% yield increases can be seen in crops with delayed irrigation. But Loosen Australia's vice chairperson, Scott Hutchings, says this water stressing is different to the mid-season dry down technique used in other crops.
For loosen, it's not necessarily a mid-season dry down. I think in any sort of stress or major stress prior to flowering, it is probably going to be detrimental. But we need to get the loosen into a flowering stage before we start stressing it, or we need to stress it to pull it into flower, into bud and flower. So stressing it during the vegetative stage isn't going to be beneficial, but stressing it once it's flowering and starting to set appears to be quite beneficial. Number of reasons for that, like in various other projects that have shown similar effects with like dropper tube irrigation where you're not wetting the canopy, can all help. But in this particular project, we're looking to purely focus on the stress of the loosen.
Did you find that there was an optimal amount of stress to put them under? Or?
Yeah, unfortunately it's quite hard to objectively measure stress. So we're working on basically using soil moisture monitors and subjective or visual assessment of the plant. And we're looking for various signs with plant wilt, and in the moderately stressed, we're looking for plant wilt and the early signs of leaf drop. And in the highly stressed, we're starting to look at, you know, a moderate amount of leaf drop prior to watering when it's in the critical stages.
This trial was done in Keith in the upper southeast. Would it be applicable in other climates and areas of different rainfall?
We're really looking for that. We've got it this final year to do on the project, and we've been granted another 2 years after. We really need to get some data from a wide range of seasons. In theory, we're entering a La Nina summer, while probably the wider growing community doesn't want a wet summer. If we do have rainfall and cooler temperatures, we might be able to further exacerbate that stress and find bigger differences in yield in a cooler year where we generally struggle to get higher yields.
The average yield increase that you found across the varieties came out at about 26%. Were you expecting that number?
Not really. It's quite a significant yield increase, so that was quite good. Not every individual variety did increase, but there was really only a couple of them that didn't respond to the stress, and their yields were relatively stable through the trial. But yeah, a lot, particularly some of the ones that have lower total yields, their percentage increase in yield was significantly better. In saying that, you know, we have to be very careful. There is still a possible cliff face where if you're stressed too much, you can lose all that gain and more. So we just need to look at more data, and individual farmers can use that basis and just have to know they may be able to push their own systems a little bit harder.
What is it about watering stress and delaying irrigation that actually causes yields to improve?
There's a number of different factors that could be doing it. The stress in itself can cause the plant to flower more and makes the flowers more turgid, which means they're more easily tripped. And when I say trip, it more easily release their pollen and pollinated by bees. It's also the factors that when a canopy's dry, the bees seem to be more keen to forage in it. We also see years where there's less summer rainfall, there's less sources of other pollen like potato weed and melons and cowfrop growing in paddocks. So they have to focus on the loosen, whereas bees don't naturally like loosen.
It's absolutely fascinating. That was Loosen Australia's Scott Hutchings speaking with Bridget Herman about this taking water away from crops mid-season to try and improve the yield. It's amazing that it actually has that effect. It doesn't reduce the yield as you might expect. Interesting results there out of some of that Loosen Australia research. This is The Country Hour. It's 19 minutes past 12.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, birds can cause major headaches for farmers, causing damage worth millions of dollars to crops across Australia. It's been an ongoing issue for Tasmanian farmer Andrew Craigie. So he's hosting a trial of a laser deterrent system called Bird Beam. Now, the trial is being run on his property at Latrobe in conjunction with Survag, and it's showing some pretty strong results so far, as Lachlan Bennett found out.
The day we planted the canola, there was 20, 25 skylarks arrived on the scene instantly. Now, the only bird actually seeing the crop that stays around is one magpie, and he must be colourblind.
What did you think when you first heard about this? Because it's a bit different.
I first heard about this technology 5 or 6 years ago in Queensland at a horticultural conference, and it was blue sky then, and it's still blue sky technology. It takes a lot to get your head around something that's there, but you can't feel it, but it works.
The laser has a very high output.
That's Michelle Kerr, the owner of Bird Beam Laser Solutions, and she's explaining how the system all works.
Because birds have an intense ocular system, they can actually see vivid colours. So the laser dot is green on the very end, we can see it on the ground, but the birds see the whole beam, similar to when if you see a lightsaber from Star Wars, that's what they see. They see the whole beam, and they see it sweeping across the paddock or the crop that you're trying to protect from point to point, and because they think it's a really large stick coming towards them, they flee the area.
Standing right here in a field of canola, I can see there's a big pole with a head on top that's rotating and a laser moving out. You just more or less just set up something like that wherever you need bird control?
We do. So we look at the site. So it's a site-by-site valuation, and we look at the best place that it's going to be to cover the crop and the best place it's going to be to take into account the undulations of the land and the surrounds. And we work really closely with the grower so that we know where the bird pressure is and where they really need the protection the most. It's set up on a pole here, and because you need height so that the angle points down towards the birds and the birds look up and they see it and they fly away. And it just does its thing. It means that the farmers can stay in bed in the morning instead of getting up and shooing the birds away.
Yeah, because I guess there's a lot of different ways to control birds that have been tried, you know, still being used in the past. Why this solution over anything else that's been used before?
The laser is humane. It's a humane bird deterrent. The birds get stuck in netting. Shotguns are used, but I mean that's not it's not PC, and it's actually not advised. People do what they have to do. They just push to the resort where they'll do anything. So the laser is humane. It's sustainable. You run it on solar or grid power. It's fully autonomic, so it just picks up and does its thing every day, programmed by time slots. And the best thing about it, it's silent.
Humane for birds, safe for humans as well?
It is a high-grade laser. So it's similar to if you were going to stand next to someone welding, you would get a welder's flash. You'd need to wear appropriate PPE, and you either would need to wear some laser safety glasses, which cancel out the light altogether, or you just turn it off before you go into the area.
And is it just for birds?
Currently, yes. It's very interesting, that conversation. So there are some interesting evaluations coming out on the effectiveness on maybe rabbits, kangaroos and the odd possum. And I guess that could probably be used for further research.
I've tried other cheaper lights and other sonic gear, but nothing that works as well as this one.
That's farmer Andrew Craigie again. He's had the bird beam operating in one of his paddocks for the past couple of months.
It's dead silent. There's nothing else. When it rains, it's the best light show you're ever going to see, though.
I guess that's an added bonus of it, isn't it?
It is an added bonus. I'd really like him to bring out a red and gold one for me so as I can put it up a tree and I'll have the best Christmas tree in Australia.
So you have a helper on the farm that used to, chase off things. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Ah, yeah, that's my dog, my tart called Sue. She's the one that chases the critters, but of late Sue's become unemployed because there is no critters left. She goes out, she looks and comes back a little bit dejected. There's nothing to chase in the paddock anymore.
Oh, she's out of a job. That's no good. Oh, well, I suppose it is good to not have the birds around. Hopefully she can find something else to do. Well, that was Latrobe farmer Andrew Craigie speaking about his experience with the laser bird deterrent system, bird beam, that's being worked on in Tasmania. And if you're interested in that story and you want to see a picture of Mr. Craigie's now out of work dog online, you can go to the ABC Rural page at abc.net.au/rural. We'll head across to the Weather Bureau now, where I'm joined by senior forecaster Jenny Horvath. Good afternoon, Jenny.
Good afternoon, Cassie.
So the weather's cooled down a bit from the start of the week, and it seems like it's going to be quite mild for a while.
Yeah, that's correct. So we've had a couple of troughs of low pressure move through. So we had really a hot day there on the Monday, and then we had that trough move through then, and then we had another one sort of move through again yesterday. Had a little bit of very light shower activity across the agricultural area yesterday. Not too much in it, though, just sort of having a look around at the bulletin this morning. A millimetre or so about the Mount Lofty ranges, sort of 0.2s and 0.4s around the mid-north and up to 0.8 on York Peninsula there, but really was very light sort of rainfall as that went through yesterday, but it has meant temperatures are on the cooler side of things for, especially across the south. We are looking at mild temperatures persisting for the next few days and into next week. Looking at weather around today, not too much going on. We might see some thunderstorm activity on our western border there with Western Australia and up in the far northwest there with Northern Territory. Not too much going on elsewhere. Maybe a little bit of shower activity around far south of the southeast. We saw a few spots earlier this morning. And we've got another cold front that will clip the south of the state coming sort of around southern waters this evening and the early hours of Friday morning there. May have a rumble of thunder with that trough moving through early Friday morning, and then we may see some shower activity along our coastal fringe with the front, and then in a sort of onshore airflow there. Still looking at the potential to see some shower activity around our northeast part of the state on the Friday and the Saturday. Maybe the storms will stay over the border there, not expecting anything there, but just that shower activity persisting in the far northwest until Sunday throughout there. And then looking around our coastal fringe, we may continue to see some shower activity around southern coasts on Saturday and Sunday, and to a lesser extent on Monday, Cassie. And then as we go on into the start of the new week, sort of looking at pretty much dry throughout the state, except for maybe on the Thursday, we might start to see some moisture coming in from our eastern states there, and we might see some thunderstorm activity northeast of Moomba on the Thursday there. And looking at some very hot temperatures still continuing today up around sort of the Moomba area, but then becoming much cooler for the weekend, and then slowly starting to see some heat coming back towards the middle of next week with some very hot temperatures around that Moomba area and the northern border, especially on Wednesday and Thursday. We're not expecting much rainfall. We're generally looking at 2 millimetres on those southern coastal fringes there, but we may see some isolated falls of 2 to 10 millimetres in our far northwest, and especially maybe with a little bit of thunderstorm activity today, Cassie.
So it sounds like a fairly typical summer at the moment with that, that weather.
Yeah, especially with the lack of rainfall, but much cooler temperatures across the agricultural area persisting. That's probably the main difference there.
And it's been rather windy by the sounds of things. Has it been quite a windy month?
Yeah, December was above average for a few of our stations with the wind speeds coming through there. So, and we're still going to see a little bit of that continuing into this week as well. And we only just have a marine warning today for our Spencer Gulf, but that will extend that to southeastern waters tomorrow.
Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
That was Jenny Horvat from the Bureau of Meteorology speaking there. Speaking of wind, in the far west of New South Wales, it's going to be quite blowy, hot and sunny in the upper western. Winds could get up to 25 to 35 k's an hour. The overnight temperatures will fall to between 17 to 25 degrees, but the daytime temperatures will reach a rather warm 30 to 39 degrees. In the lower western, the winds could get up to 40 k's an hour in the morning. Overnight temperatures will fall to about 11 to 18 degrees, and the daytime temperatures will reach about 30. It is coming up to 12:30.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Cassie Huff.
Hi, so glad you could join me today. Soon I'm going to be looking at what's happening with the Pacific Island workers. Late last year, the state government made way for them to come into South Australia. I'll have more on what's happening there. And have you enjoyed some fish and chips this summer? There's been some great weather for it. Well, the state government's been encouraging people to think about maybe eating some of the less well-known fish, like mulloway or maybe orange jacket.
But it's excellent eating fish, lovely white flesh. I mean, I remember as a lobster fisherman cooking it up, but we'd catch a lot of it in our pots, just bycatch, and thinking how, you know, remarkable the flesh was.
So how has that funding gone to boost the sales of these so far underutilised fish? I'll have more on that shortly. If you have perhaps tried some different fish species that you wouldn't normally eat, I'd love to hear. You can text in on 0467 922 891 or call 1300 222 891. But we'll find out what's making news now with Wendy Glamachek.
Good afternoon, Cassie. In the news this hour, the second impeachment of US President Donald Trump is now official and is on its way to the Senate. Upper House approval is required for Mr. Trump to be removed from office early. But the Republican Senate leader says there is no chance that a fair or serious trial can be held before President-elect Joe Biden is sworn in next week. The federal government says that households and businesses have accumulated more than $200 billion in savings since the pandemic took hold. Household deposits into savings accounts increased by almost $113 billion between January of 2020 and the end of last November. The Treasurer argues that the data shows there's a huge sum of cash which can be spent once JobKeeper and JobSeeker are due to end in March. And SA Health plans to start rolling out a coronavirus vaccine to South Australians from mid-February. The first to receive a jab will be those more vulnerable to the virus, like residents and staff of aged care facilities and frontline workers, including healthcare workers and medi-hotel staff. Two doses of the vaccine will be required. SA Health says vaccination for the rest of the population will be available from the middle of this year. More ABC News at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for that, Wendy. Now, it seems 100 workers, around about 100 workers from Vanuatu are going to fly into South Australia from next week. That's to deal with the worker shortage that agriculture right across the country is facing. Now, in South Australia, the busiest time of year for stone fruit has passed. That's where the activity has been recently. But other ag industries like citrus and fruit and vegetable growers are still worried about where they're going to find their workers. Now, in New South Wales, the state government there is pushing for a new national quarantine centre in regional Australia where the Pacific Island workers could come in on charter flights direct to a regional location. Now, the Agriculture Minister there, Adam Marshall, says that part of the problem is the federal government's cap on arrivals and prioritising returning Australians over foreign workers coming in, and he believes that this could be a solution.
We estimate in New South Wales alone we need just a little over 5,000 ag workers from overseas between now and the middle of the year. And currently under the current federal visa program, we've only had 2,000 workers come into the whole country since COVID started, which is a shortage of around 34,000 workers. So, look, I'm pleading with our federal counterparts. This is a national problem and we need some national leadership. And my state colleagues and I have raised this constantly with the Commonwealth, that it is an issue well beyond the scope of any individual state government. I mean, we have caps, physical caps on how many international visitors can come in through Brisbane, Sydney and Melbourne. And the federal government's telling us that priority has to be given to returning Australians, not ag workers, not overseas students, but returning Australians. And I just worry that unless this is sorted out relatively quickly, we're going to have some major problems, not just in rural areas with regard to producers being able to get their crop off, but in the major urban centres and capital cities, with less than full shelves and what is on the shelf costing consumers a hell of a lot more. Now, at the most recent Ag Ministers meeting, there was a proposal put to have a national ag worker quarantine facility where instead of flying the ag workers in through Brisbane, Sydney and Melbourne airports where you hit the international arrival cap, we have a facility outside of those capital cities where we can fly by charter flight the ag workers direct to that quarantine facility and actually quarantine those people there, which is closer to their final destination of work anyway. But the feds aren't interested in that. They say that's the state's problem and the states have to fix it. So
is this just a cost-shifting issue that the feds don't want to pay for a national quarantine facility?
It's not only a cost-shifting, it's a buck-passing exercise. I mean, I'd be prepared as a New South Wales Agriculture Minister to say if there was a national facility or a national-led initiative, New South Wales would be financially willing to contribute to that and contribute our share on a pro-rata basis based on the workforce that we need. I mean, realistically, New South Wales, Queensland and Victoria, the three big eastern states are the ones that need the most workers, and we should foot most of the bill. But
well, there are none in Victoria, so are you talking to them about that sort of idea?
Yes, I am. Absolutely, I am. And I'm hopeful that I can make an announcement very soon, David, because my view at the moment is that no point waiting for the Commonwealth. We've got to take the initiative, and whether it's states operating individually, I'd like to see us actually operate together and establish our own overseas agricultural worker quarantine facility outside of Brisbane, Sydney or Melbourne where we can fly workers in directly.
Where would that be?
There. Well, that's what we're working on at the moment, to find an ideal facility, and it might have to be a number of facilities given the sheer volume of workers we need. A facility that would be cheaper to quarantine in than quarantining people in hotel rooms guarded by police forces in the various capital cities where we can get those people in straight away.
That was the New South Wales Agriculture Minister, Adam Marshall, speaking to David Claughton. Now, he was obviously focusing on the eastern states, but South Australian producers have been calling for more support for some time as well. I believe about 9,000 workers are required across the state over the course of the year. Stone fruit harvest is just starting to wind down, but the citrus harvest that doesn't begin for a few months, they're very concerned about where their workers are going to come from, and the state government has been working on this. I'm joined by the Primary Industries Minister, David Basham. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Kate.
So do you support your New South Wales counterpart's calls for a regional quarantine facility that would get around these caps on the number of people who can come through the capital city airports?
I don't think from South Australian perspective at this stage that's necessary. We haven't had the same pressures that they seem to have had in the eastern states. We've been working with the horticulture industry here in South Australia for many months now, and back in December announced our plan to assist them in this space, and which includes bringing some workers in, but that's certainly not our priority. It's certainly about getting locals out there if we can, very much about trying to get the workforce that's mobilised, whether it be university students on holidays between lectures years, etc., or whether it be other people within the regions. But we've put on the table some money to get people out to the regions. We've also put some money on the table to assist with the quarantine of bringing workers in if need be.
With those students, I think you were giving them $2,000. Have you had any students take that up?
There's certainly been a lot of interest. It's still early days, effectively, to see whether there's been significant uptake, and I don't have those numbers in front of me. But we certainly, in getting Pacific workers to come into South Australia. We've only had four companies actually make inquiry to do that, and we're working with them to actually get those numbers. And you know, the reports today of 100 coming in from Vanuatu is certainly one of those four. But there's not a huge pressure that we're seeing in the eastern states. NFF did some work in this space and have been having a look at the numbers. And at this point in time, the losses of reports from South Australia of fruit not being picked, there actually have been no reports as such made through the NFF process.
Where are those 100 Vanuatu workers quarantining?
They'll be in quarantining in the same way, manner as normal, through the hotel quarantine system. They'll having to meet the same rules as dictated by Health here in SA to go through that 14-day quarantine. The only thing is that we will be giving assistance of $500 per worker towards the quarantine cost in bringing those workers across, because it is important that we do get those fruit off those trees in the time-critical environment that they operate in.
So the South Australian government is contributing somewhat to the cost, but it is the business owner who is requiring these workers from Vanuatu who are paying most of the cost. Is that correct?
Yep, that's right. They'll certainly be paying the lion's share of it, but we are making a commitment to support in some of $500 per worker.
I've spoken with people from the citrus industry who say that they are going to need workers. They don't start their harvest for a couple of months, though, yet. So will programs like the students program continue, given a couple of months they'll be back at uni?
We'll continue work with horticulture to make sure that we can find the workforce that's required. At this point in time, we've actually been able to do what's needed to get the workers there. It's not been as simple as it has in past years, where you can just go and get the backpackers that are going through the towns to do the work. There has been a bit more effort to get the workers there, but we actually seem to have been able to do that in South Australia.
So you don't support the need for a regional quarantine facility that the eastern states have been calling for? Not needed in South Australia?
At this point in time, it's not seen to be needed in South Australia.
Thanks for your time today and an update on those numbers of people coming into South Australia from Vanuatu. About 100 workers, the federal government's saying, will be coming into South Australia. So I guess that goes some way, but I know the South Australian government has very much focused on trying to get domestic people, workers, into some of these jobs that are needed. So thanks for your time today.
My pleasure.
That was the Primary Industries Minister, David Basham, just giving an update on where the worker situation is for South Australia. And we've still got quite a lot of crop to come off before the season's finished. A lot of vegetables are still going and apples will be being harvested soon. I'll have more on that shortly. But I think the industry that is perhaps the most affected, really struggling to get workers, is the meat industry in the eastern states. Fijians have been working in abattoirs in Juni and Cootamundra since November, but they don't have any more arrivals planned. And that's despite participant rates for Australians in the meatworks industry falling to historically low levels. And there's actually about a shortfall of about 3,500 workers nationwide. Patrick Hutchinson is the CEO of the Australian Meat Industry Council, and he told David Claughton that the industry is working on a special meat industry visa, but in the meantime, individual companies are handling the quarantine and flight arrangements for overseas workers in the same way that David Basham just alluded to there. But here's some of what Patrick Hutchinson had to say.
We've allowed the individual companies to do this themselves. However, I think what this is more about is showing that we can actually make this work, especially in a time where we're seeing record livestock prices. We need to be making sure that as an industry that we can continue to at least underpin our businesses in this hard time for processing, so that as the herd grows and as the flock grows and as product comes onto the system, then in fact we have enough capacity to be able to slaughter those animals and provide more meat around the world as well as domestically, because at the moment we are still struggling for workers like a lot of other regional businesses are.
Well, Meatworks are paying a high price for the actual meet. I understand they're also paying the quarantine costs and the flight costs to bring workers in?
That's correct, as we're led to believe, because, again, we need those workers. We've seen a lot of rhetoric that's been going on the past couple of weeks in regards to, you know, seasonal workers and fruit pickers, and even yesterday the acting Prime Minister making the call out to get people to come out from metropolitan Australia, regional Australia. We want a permanent workforce. We don't want a transitional workforce or a transient workforce. We need a permanent workforce. And there's a number of key aspects that we've put forward in late last year to about seven different cabinet ministers, who all of which, federal cabinet ministers, all of which gave us the time, all of which talked about the importance of the processing industry in Australia. I think that we should recognise...
Pacific workers don't give you that permanent workforce, do they? At best, I think they give you a couple of years.
They can, but you know, if we can work forward in that time period with permanent residency, or in fact, if we can start to underpin, it's about giving ourselves the opportunity to create a national and international workforce which can underpin at any times permanency throughout the process. You know, we've put forward a very strong Australian meat industry visa program to a number of different cabinet ministers. We've undertaken that with KPMG. That final report is due out shortly. And, clear to that is the opportunity for us to look at some of the key schematics around the visa process. You know, so we're talking about English, we're talking about access to permanent residency, we're talking about, you know, key other key areas such as when we as an industry have to pay tax for a visa worker to start, and then when they finish we also pay another tax which goes into the Skilling Australia Fund, of which we don't then get the opportunity to extract that money back out ourselves to skill Australians. It makes it almost impossible for us to look at visa workers at a long-term basis because they're actually more expensive than local workers.
Patrick Hutchinson, who is the CEO of the Australian Meat Industry Council, speaking there about the dire situation that their worker situation in meat workers across the country is in at the moment. Listening to the Country Hour, it's 14 minutes to one. Now, I mentioned the citrus industry are keen to get workers ahead of their season, which starts in a couple of months. But before then, South Australia's apples have to be harvested. And Susie Green is the CEO of Apple and Pear and Cherry Growers South Australia. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Kath.
So South Australia's apples are largely grown close to Adelaide. How are growers getting workers for that industry?
So far we're fairly fortunate because we are close to Adelaide, as you say. So most of our workforce is the domestic workforce. So far so good. We seem to be getting enough workers for thinning, but time will tell when it comes to harvest, but we're certainly in a more fortunate position than some of the other industries that are further out.
And so I can't imagine there's any push to get Pacific Island workers from the apple and cherry growers.
Not in the short term. It's certainly something that we would still continue to look at in the medium to longer term, but no short-term immediate need.
It's probably, about 4 weeks or so away from South Australia's apple, Adelaide Hills apples, being picked. How are they looking?
So far, so good. It looks like it's shaping up to be a pretty good crop. It's a larger crop than last year, and the fruit is sizing well and starting to colour up, so it's really popping out on the trees. And, fingers crossed, but so far it's shaping up to look like it's going to be a great season.
Oh, that is some good news. And it's sunlight I think you need at the moment. You might have noticed if you're driving through the Adelaide Hills, sometimes you see some reflective mats on the ground around apple orchards. That's to try and reflect some of the light back up onto the apples and give them an all-over red colour. Are the apples getting their rosy colour, given it's cooled off a bit recently?
Yeah, so, I mean, this sort of weather that's not too extreme heat, just nice, warm days and cooler nights is actually ideal for fruit to ripen and colour up nicely. So, yeah, we're certainly starting to see the colour really appear. And as you said, we'll start to see some of that reflective matting going out in the next week or two or three, closer to harvest.
Now, you also represent the cherry growers. There have been reports in the Chinese media that the taste and quality of Australian cherries over there isn't as good as it once was. Now, not a lot of South Australian cherries go to China, but have you heard these concerns?
Certainly. We you know, we don't have any evidence of that sort of feedback coming back to our suppliers. The fruit that was that I tasted on the domestic market this year was really good quality. It was, really nice, good-sized, decent cherries this year. So, it may well just be a one-off rather than a trend, I suspect.
Okay. And I guess for apple and cherry growers, one of the biggest risks at this time of year is hail, and the state government put $14.6 million towards grants for farmers to put up some hail netting. How's that program going?
So it's rolling out really well. There's been a huge amount of demand, so the netting companies are very busy trying to get quotes in, and growers are getting quotes in the system so that they can put their applications in to start fast-tracking the netting. But we've already seen, I think, close to half of the Adelaide Hills Fund has been allocated, so that's great, and there's certainly quite a bit more in the pipeline yet to come. So it's been really well received by industry, and it's certainly going to be a big positive going forward.
How much difference do you think it's going to make to the industry?
Oh, massive. I think it's really a matter of if you don't have some kind of netting into the future, you really won't be surviving. It's certainly in a lot of the fruit industries, apples, pears, cherries and so forth, really will become critical. We've seen lots and lots of bird activity this year. With the, you know, the hotter weather, there's just so many benefits to the netting that it really is a must-have for the industry.
Well, that's interesting. It's already only been 6 months into the program that's meant to go until 2023, and it sounds like it's already quite well subscribed. So I'd be interested to see how long that money lasts for. Thanks for that, Susie.
No worries at all.
That was Susie Green, the CEO of Apple and Pear and Cherry Growers SA, speaking about a few issues there with the apples and cherries that are grown in this state. It is 10 minutes to one. And we're going to head to Port Lincoln now, because a local seafood processor in Port Lincoln is hoping new funding will help boost sales of a so far underutilised fish in the market. Moree Seafood at Port Lincoln has recently received funding through the state government's Regional Growth Fund with the aim is to help with processing, exporting and marketing the ocean jacket. Now, I have never eaten an ocean jacket. I'd love to know what you think about these fish. You can text in 0467 922 891. Andrew Ferguson from Moree Seafood says that ocean jackets are great tasting fish, and they're hoping to be able to get it out to more people.
Oh, ocean jackets have obviously been a fishery for the last 30 years, and you know it's been caught on and off. But it isn't, you're right, it's not known widely across the local market, but it is an excellent eating fish, lovely white flesh. I mean, I remember as a lobster fisherman cooking it up, but we'd catch a lot of it in our pots, just bycatch. And, thinking how remarkable sort of the flesh was. And so that's what we're looking to do, is expand that opportunity through into the export market and into the local market.
Where can you export ocean jacket to?
Oh, there are ocean jackets caught, of course, around the world in Southeast Asia, off India, into that Asian market. It is known, and there is a market for it. We've been sending most of our ocean jackets in bulk in 10-kilo boxes frozen into China, and some into Southeast Asia as well. Most of it is unpacked and then packed in fairly ordinary packaging in Glad Wrap and things like that, and sold into, and then rebranded and put into their local market. We're thinking what we want to do is to add our flair of branding to it and attain a higher price by selling it as a retail product rather than a bulk commodity into the market.
I guess that's where this funding comes in. Tell us about what you'll use this Regional Growth Fund for.
We're planning on expanding our capability in Port Lincoln, in the factory there, to just encompass the areas that we're looking to niche the product to, and the processing equipment needed to accommodate that, and we also do other fish species as well. But it'll sort of align ourselves to being more efficient of the way we operate in the packaging and the filleting, etc. So yeah, it's just really to make it more efficient, give the factory more efficiencies, focused on the higher end looking
product output.
Is Ocean Jacket something do you have to package differently, or is it something similar to what you might see with, say, a King George Whiting or something like that?
Well, the format we sell it in, a bulk format to Asia now, is the trunk. We actually do sell the cheek meat and filleted as well, and that's sold in our retail packaging in Australia on the local market. So, you know, there's a number of different choices we can go, of format we can actually offer the market, and we'll work on that as we work through it. But probably to start off with, it's going to be the trunk format in a retail version.
What has 2020 meant for Ocean Jacket sales? Obviously, with restaurants having to shut, that would have been a market loss for a little while.
Yeah, well, probably not so much in Australia, but in China, it hasn't been. The COVID thing hasn't helped us much in China. I mean, there's been a lot of pushback in China with packaging coming into China, and particularly coming from nations Chinese were saying that the COVID has come in on the packaging. I'm not sure how that can happen, but there's been a bit of a reluctancy over the last few months, and so the orders haven't been as strong. But just lately, we've sent a couple of shipments out. So, you know, that's probably where it's affected us the most, I suppose, is the export market and around COVID issues.
And what is the Ocean Jacket fishing industry like? Is there many fishermen out there catching Ocean Jacket?
Yeah, well, there's three or four main Ocean Jacket fishermen who have targeted Ocean Jacket licences, which is stem from the marine scale sector. So, and then there's the trawl sector that target it as well. Don't actually target it, it's a bycatch, but sometimes they catch more or less. So really, there's the two main areas. Lots caught along the east coast as well, but it's never really been properly developed because of the value. We're about looking at bringing the value of the fishery up more to the boats and really making something of the product. Seeing it's such a wonder product and it's underutilised, and this is part of the project as well, is about these underutilised species, and obviously Ocean Jacket being a large volume fishery, and looking at trying to add value to that factor, and that's what we're endeavouring to do with the project.
Andrew Ferguson from Mori Seafood speaking with Brooke Neindorf. Had a text in from John saying, is the Ocean Jacket a leather jacket that lives in deeper water? I think that's a quite funny comment. And Charlie from Angara says that he recently bought a whole Ocean Jacket having no idea what it was. He was unaware that it had quite large bones, but after 5 minutes of filleting, he made himself a lovely fish stew, and the bones made the best stock he'd ever tasted before. That is great to hear. I haven't tried it yet, but on that recommendation, I might give it a go. Thanks, Charlie. Finally today, to a fish that we do know well, and that is the snapper. The state government, as I was saying, is releasing 300,000 snapper fingerlings into waters off South Australia to try and boost the numbers. But an industry leader's saying that they need to make sure that they're actually monitoring the release of these snapper. The Marine Fishers Association Executive Officer, Dr. Gary Morgan, welcomes this move to release the snapper fingerlings, but says similar projects overseas have had mixed results.
It is a process that's been tried in a number of places around the world, and in some places it works, and unfortunately in some places it doesn't work. So monitoring is the key to this. Just releasing fingerlings and forgetting about them and crossing your fingers is not the way to go. They need to be monitored to make sure that those fingerlings that are being released actually do contribute to the snapper stocks.
We're saying that if the government does monitor them very closely and then finds out these fingerlings are being predated at an extraordinarily high rate by other species, I mean, what can they really do about it to right the ship?
Well, there's nothing you can do about it in that case. There's a good example in Japan, where for more than 20 years they conducted a release program, in this case of shrimp larvae. And then when they got round to actually seeing what impact they had, they'd found that there was absolutely no increase in the wild prawn stocks as a result of those releases. By contrast, particularly in freshwater, there's fish releases of trout and salmon in rivers around the world. That does have a very direct and immediate impact on wild stocks. And the closest thing, I think, to snapper that I know of is a release program that's been undertaken over the past 5 or so years in the United Arab Emirates in Dubai, where they release grouper fingerlings, and that seems to have a small impact, but the jury's still out on that one.
How unusual is this project, though? Because it sounds like there are several others around the world, but how unusual is it to sort of grow these fingerlings in a controlled environment, to grow snapper in particular, and then release them into the wild in hopes that they'll repopulate the fishery?
That's exactly how it's done in other places. They use aquaculture to produce the fingerlings and then release them. But as I said, it's the monitoring of the impacts that's essential. And also with snapper, you have to remember that the fingerlings, if they do survive, they won't reach legal size to be caught for 3 to 4 years. So we won't see any impact at all for the next 3 or 4 years. And of course, during those 3 or 4 years, the fingerlings are out there, and there's other fish would love a tasty meal of aquacultured fingerlings.
Marine Fishers Association Executive Officer Dr. Gary Morgan speaking with Lucas Forbes. That's all we have time for in the Country Hour. I'll be back tomorrow, though. It's coming up to 1 o'clock.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.